Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at acultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. This episode features an interview with Dr. David Shoemaker, author of Living Thelema, A Practical Guide to Attainment in Aleister Crowley's System of Magic. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section. Membership provides access to a tremendous archive of interviews for a low monthly fee while helping to support the production and distribution of the show. Please consider subscribing if you haven't already. This episode is also made possible by additional donations from Steve, Lance, Diana, Nicole, and Johnny. Thanks again. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Thelesis Aura, an occult media production, education, and resource company. Publishers of Lon Milo Duquette's Tarot of Ceremonial Magic. Distributors of Kat Luneau's Sacred Imagery. And host to online training and instruction by some of the world's leading teachers of the esoteric arts. For more, visit ThelesisAura.com. Now, in episode number 147, our guest is Dr. David Shoemaker, author of Living Thelema, A Practical Guide to Attainment in Aleister Crowley's System of Magic. You can find his website at livingthelema.com. Dr. David Shoemaker is a clinical psychologist in private practice, specializing in Jungian and cognitive behavioral psychotherapy. David is the chancellor of the International College of Thelema and the prolocutor of its initiatory order, the Temple of the Silver Star. He has also been a member of OTO and a student of AA since 1993, and he has more than 15 years' experience supervising students in these traditions. In addition to serving in numerous OTO leadership and EGC ecclesiastical roles with distinction, Dr. Shoemaker was instrumental in the publication of several notable and important books, including Jane Wolfe, The Cefalu Diaries, 1920-1923, and The Thoth Tarot, Astrology and Other Selected Writings, and The Kabbalah, Magic and Thelema, Selected Writings, Volume 2, both by Phyllis Seckler. Shoemaker's book, Living Thelema, A Practical Guide to Attainment in Aleister Crowley's System of Magic, is adapted from the popular segment of the same name featured in the excellent Speech in the Silence podcast. Living Thelema brings a welcome approachability to Crowley's material without diminishing the depth of the system. By focusing on the practical and experiential aspects of the path of Thelema, Shoemaker allows the reader to grasp the true transformative power of the system. His background as a practicing psychotherapist allows an entirely unique fusion of esoteric wisdom and cognitive science. Not only is the book recommended by luminaries of the Thelemic tradition, but it is an important and many would argue necessary text that will aid multitudes of Thelemites as they pursue the great work. Eminently practical, but also inspiring, Living Thelema deserves your attention, and I highly recommend all of Dr. Shoemaker's work. David Shoemaker, I want to welcome you to the show. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I've been wanting to talk with you since, actually for quite a while, but definitely since the release of your recent book, Living Thelema, A Practical Guide to Attainment in Aleister Crowley's System of Magic, which I recently got myself and have been quite impressed with, and seems like has been received with some acclaim by the Thelemic community for sure.
Well, thanks for saying so. It's done really well. I've been really happy with the reception, and just kind of excited to get that out there as a statement about where I've been the last 20 years and what I've learned, and hopefully it will help some people just to have it in an accessible form like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about the book, but before we do, I'd like to begin by asking you if you could, for people who aren't already familiar, describe your interest in and history with esoteric studies and practice.
Sure. Well, for me, it always in some ways goes back to my parents, because I had a very rationalist, kind of scientifically minded philosophy professor as a father. And my mother, on the other hand, is a very creative person from a very religious family, a Methodist family, a lot of clergy in the family and such. So I was really steeped in these two very different worldviews growing up, and really respecting them both. But, you know, I see one of the tasks of my childhood is figuring out how to reconcile these things. So that was the foundation of some of my exploration of these ideas. I then moved on to get very interested in Carl Jung in high school, and soon after determined to go into psychology as a profession. Only after graduating from college and getting into a doctoral program in psychology, where I was getting once again but at a deeper level, exposure to Jung, I realized that my seeking was much more of a spiritual quest than an intellectual one. I think I'd been kind of rationalizing it as, casting it all sort of in the context of becoming a therapist, a psychologist, and more of an intellectual understanding of it. But I was reading Jung and realizing that I had a feeling of kind of an ache for mystery. What I was loving about Jung was the idea that there was this huge world in the mind and consciousness in general, in humanity, and not just at the individual level, but at the collective level, as you know, of course, Jung puts quite a bit of focus on that. And somehow in that period of time, around it was early 1993, I came across Israel Regardi and his Middle Pillar book. And in that book, he explicitly weaves together Kabbalistic psychology and Jungian psychology, and of course talks a bit about the work of Aleister Crowley. So at that point, I was hooked. I felt like my destiny had sort of fallen into my lap, and began exploring which magical orders were out there to get involved in. At that point, entered into the student phase of the AA, and got initiated into the OTO, and that was really the beginning of the journey. Soon after, 3 or 4 years after that, having made the acquaintance of Phyllis Eckler, Sora Merrill, who became my primary spiritual teacher, I had moved out to California in 1997 and began working closely with her. And that kind of completed a circle for me of finding a spiritual home and really finding an expression of my life purpose, you know, my true will and a context to do that work. And so I've been working as an outgrowth primarily of my work with Sora Merrill since that time, and that's kind of brought me to the present day.
Excellent. Thank you very much. What is it about Aleister Crowley's Thelema that you find so compelling, and that others do as well, obviously?
Well, you have to start with the law, for one thing. I'll talk about Crowley himself in a minute, but the law of Thelema, you know, as many people know, is a exquisitely simple doctrine to express, but a very difficult one to live. A challenging one, a beautiful one, but difficult. And what has always fascinated me about the approach is kind of that dichotomy that at root we're saying all you've got to do is find the one purpose for which you have come to the planet and do everything possible moment to moment, week to week, year to year, decade to decade of your life to express that purpose, to create a life that has space to live out that purpose, that will with intensity and joy and harmony. And the simplicity of that is so intriguing and fascinating. And the challenge of in every moment kind of questioning, am I really honoring my will in this moment? Am I honoring myself? Without any, and this is important, without any of the accretions of dogma or the unnecessary weight of belief that you have to buy into some sort of particular fairy tale about how the universe came to be, or that you have to revere someone as a divine figure, you know, to be able to cast that stuff aside and simply focus on finding the divinity within oneself and devoting one's life to be a place where that can happen. So that, broadly speaking, in terms of Thelema, that's what I've just loved about the philosophy. Crowley himself fascinated me from the beginning because I suppose, like many people, I'd only heard the stupid rumors and not well-informed rumors. And so coming to actually read Crowley in those early days in the early 90s and being so profoundly moved by his intelligence and wit and his, you know, the poet in him expressing itself in his attempts to convey spiritual teachings, just captured me. And I mean, everyone has their things of Crowley's that they like more or like less, but overall, I think he was the person who needed to come through and do the particular job that he did. And, you know, according to his true will, and I'm just thankful that he did it. So I guess that's a fair statement of why I'm into this.
This sort of challenging aspect of Crowley's character or personality or life story, if you will, seems to be a point of contention for people who I think would otherwise be greatly attracted to Thelema and Crowley's magical writings. A lot of times I hear things like, you know, well, Thelema's interesting or effective, but I have issues with Crowley as a person. And I find that interesting, especially in consideration of the fact that, you know, there's many far more sinister and evil figures associated with every major world religion that would sure. eclipse any, you know, negative personality traits of Crowley, to be sure. But yes. I just wonder what's your opinion about this aspect of Crowley that seems so challenging to people who are interested in esotericism generally?
Yeah, first let me just echo one of the statements you just made to emphasize that it's absolutely absurd to think that while there's something in any way acceptable about, say, politicians pressing buttons to drop bombs on people. But if Crowley was into free sex and maybe had a drug problem and was encouraging people to break out of societal restrictions and maybe had a good-sized ego and, you know, that sort of thing. Good Lord. I mean, compare that to what we see in the world around us by the people that we elect or don't. And I think the whole argument kind of breaks down into absurdity. But in any case, when it comes specifically to Crowley's personality and people drawn to the occult otherwise and getting turned off by Crowley, I think to some extent I'm seeing a change there. That's one of those areas where in my time in Thelema I've seen some improvement in the climate out there, where there I find myself talking to people coming from quarters other than self professed Thelemites, and they are having a much more nuanced understanding of Crowley's work. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hearing more comments like, yeah, that Crowley was quite a character. I really like some of what he did. I don't know if that's the specific approach for me, but, you know, it's interesting. You know, so a little less of the boogeyman reflexive repulsion and more more nuanced kind of response. Yeah. Go ahead.
That's encouraging for sure.
Yeah, and granted, I'm mostly in California, so I'm around a more progressive culture in some places, but I've heard that all over the place, and you come across that more on the internet than you used to. Mm-hmm. Now that said, I think, as has been said by a number of people in the past, Crowley's lack of interest in kind of dumbing things down or softening his words in order to make them appear less palatable or less dark or whatever, I think is actually ultimately a strength, because if people really aren't willing to read past or to move past some of their initial shock or resistance or fear, just plain fear, to get to really read his writings and understand what he's talking about, they're unlikely to profit from the system. So some of that's kind of a built-in test of persistence, I suppose.
Yeah, that's kind of how it seems in a way.
Not that I think there's a space now for popular culture, for mass media to get a better glimpse of what Thelema can be about that isn't totally defined by decades old regurgitated pejoratives about Crowley.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of excited to see what happens in the next couple of decades, because I think that we've kind of got a foot in the door right now.
It seems like things are ripe for change, at least, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
So getting back to your personal work, could you talk a little bit about how the Living Thelema segment for speech in the podcast kind of grew into, first I guess they put it on YouTube, and then now you have the book, and it seems like it's really blossomed.
Yeah, Speech in the Silence is the name of the podcast. And the way that came about was, I guess it's been maybe 4 years now. It's hard to believe, but the Speech in the Silence had just started. I think they'd had one episode, and I was in a place where, you know, for much of the last 20 years, I've been in the position to be teaching small groups, and much of that has been in the context of preparing monthly or bi-monthly classes. So I had this, you know, this collection of folders full of class notes and collected ideas on a number of different topics that were all pretty fundamental to understanding Thelema and getting going in it as a system. So I had a set of materials that were kind of ready-made to record and present to an audience bigger than would fit in the temple in my backyard, and saw the podcast come along and thought, you know, let's do that. So I started recording these segments, usually 20 to 25 minutes long, that initially, especially, were drawn from the kinds of classes and topics I'd be presenting anyway. Seemed to really take off. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know whether there'd be people out there finding value in my particular approach to things in a broader way. But it really took off. And after 2 or 3 years of that, having had these podcasts recorded, of course, I decided to go ahead and turn that into a book and try to make that permanently available in an easily accessible and inexpensive form. And as we said earlier, it seems to have been embraced really well. I'm very pleased with it.
I find myself returning to it, looking at certain sections again and again. I think it is quite useful.
Good. Thank you. Yeah. I tried to make it so that it would be useful across a spectrum of experience in terms of the readership. Like, it's not intended to replace all the basic foundational materials that Crowley's already written. You're still going to want to have if you're into the paper, paper books, you'll want to have maybe Gems from the Equinox and Magic Without Tears, Magic in Theory and Practice, or Liber ABA, things like that to refer to. So it doesn't replace or reprint any of that. It's designed to be something where a person can read some of the foundational materials from Crowley, and then, okay, now it's time to practice this ritual. What advice is out there? And you pick up my book, and there's advice from someone who's been practicing this and supervising and teaching people to do this for a couple decades, and hopefully able to help people avoid some of the pitfalls or blind alleys that can come along with these practices. So, to some extent, it's for beginners who want to start doing stuff. On another level, there's much more advanced stuff in there that's not going to make much sense to complete beginners, but will hopefully be an interesting overview and kind of re-examination of more advanced materials like the approach to knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, the crossing of the abyss, how to understand the system of AA in terms of what it's actually doing within a person. What are the transformative powers of working this system, as opposed to just looking once again at a, you know, tree of life discussion of the different tasks of AA. Mm-hmm. Trying to make something interesting and useful for people from beginner to advanced. Was an interesting challenge, and I'm hoping that that mostly has succeeded.
Yeah, it seems, at least on the surface, that it is. One of the things that I'm curious about, the title of the book and the segment is Living Thelema. It's about practically applying Thelemic philosophy to magical practice, to daily life. But at the same time, it implies this idea of something alive, a living tradition, something that is embodied now by many people. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about, I guess, the vibrancy of the Thelemic tradition, because in just in terms of numbers or general production of esoteric work, the Thelemic community seems quite vibrant, in my opinion.
Yes, yes. And the title, Living Thelema, kind of has a number of meanings depending on how you read it. But first of all, the genesis of that name was that I knew what I didn't want to do. And it wasn't, I didn't want to get on and do a podcast or a book about history. I didn't want to do another book that was simply, here are the basic rituals and how to do them, with another reprint of the pentagram ritual. And, you know, I didn't want it to be just that or mostly that. I wanted it to be about what it's like to live your life as a Thelemite, including what does it mean to have relationships as a Thelemite? What does it mean to need help and go to psychotherapy if you're a Thelemite? How do you understand that process as a magician? You know, questions of daily experience and how to make Thelema relevant, how to make daily experience relevant to Thelema and vice versa. So that's one aspect of the living part. But yeah, as a vibrant esoteric culture, I am really excited to see what's happening in Thelema now. It seems like, especially with internet communities growing up, where communication is so much easier between people who belong to non-normative traditions, it seems like we're really set for what I hope is an explosion of cultural influence based on the tenets of Thelema and all the good people who are out there trying to apply it in whatever field of endeavor they do, you know, whatever their job is, whatever their situation.
Well, one of the aspects of Thelema that draws people's attention and interest is the sexual magic and mysticism. And you do have a section on that in your book.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the idea of sexual magic. It's obviously a crucial component to Thelema and the Thelemic philosophy, but in many ways, I feel like this Western tantric system is, I would almost say, like the underground stream that exists in Western esotericism, but yet never emerged in any significant form until, well, you could argue the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, but until Crowley really came out with his books. And even then, it was somewhat obscured.
Right.
So, there's the question is kind of muddled there. But basically, your opinions about sexual magic in Thelema and how you can address that in a succinct form in your book, yet still do so effectively.
The basic thing to understand about sex magic is that it is first and foremost magic. A sexual magic working has many of the same hallmarks of any other ritual in terms of how you structure it. You know, you want to cleanse the space and yourself with some banishings. You want to have a clearly defined purpose. You want to apply the right sort of energy using the right symbols to the right object and find a way to lock in the results. That what I've just said applies to any ritual, and it certainly applies to sexual magic ritual. And you know, we have to use the term ritual broadly here. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, what we're really doing with sexual magic is utilizing a particular force resident in the human body that is an expression of the divine creative power inherent in our existence, and harnessing that force to the magical goals that we've set up. I think, as you said, Crowley was really the first successful Western proponent of sexual magic in the sense of really getting the word out about it. And even though in his lifetime he spoke about it in veiled terms, clearly his work planted the seeds for it to be much more in the consciousness of Western occultists. And to talk about it, what I decided to do was, rather than only talk about the mechanics of getting it all accomplished, I wanted to talk about ways to think about preparations for doing the work, ways to think about the inner transformations of the self and the psyche and the body that that make it work. And so what I did was I broke down the chapter into discussions of basically three phases, where first you have to purify to sort of wash away the accretions of shame and guilt and body negativity and sex negativity that have been so prevalent in Western Judeo-Christian culture, so that the sex force, which we might call Kundalini, or we might call the Mars force or something, so that force is perceived as the divine thing that it is, so that there's no leftover sense of shame about sexuality in the body. And so I talk about ways to do that. And then once you've done that, you move into a consecration phase where you practice devoting that now purified energy to the aim of your choice. So that might be, so essentially devotional practices, but using sexual force. So the idea of having a bhakti yoga style approach to it, where you've got a chosen deity and you are devoting your ecstasy, sexual ecstasy, to this deity, or similar things like that. So you practice, now that you've got the force cleansed and ready to go, you practice aiming at where you want it to go. And then finally, in the third part of that chapter, I talk about the ways to structure the magical ritual itself, and some pointers about managing sexual arousal and communication with your partner, and things like that, just sort of practicalities. Mm-hmm. So it was a fun challenge to figure out how to talk about that in a chapter. And it's, as is probably not surprising, it's a very popular lecture, commonly requested lecture when I go somewhere.
I found it very interesting, and I appreciated the fact that you talked about Kundalini. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was this force, you call it Kundalini or the sexual energy, or might even be able to kind of relate it or conflate it with the idea of astral light. But what's your experience in terms of the accretion of this etheric substance, with the quote fingers, if you will, by people engaging in a daily magical practice or meditative practice that they may not actually be focused specifically on Kundalini or sexual energy, but
right.
I think by practicing some sort of ritual daily, whether devotional, magical, ceremonial, whatever, combined with meditation, it often brings about an accretion of this energy. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
That's a great question. Yes, I think the daily magical rituals done by magicians of any stripe, whether they're conceiving of them as thelemic or whether they're conceiving of them as in any way related to sexual magic, are dealing with the same forces that we're talking about with sexual magic. Just because it isn't explicitly experienced as sexual or even sensual necessarily, doesn't mean it isn't of the same substance. And when we spend months and years, day in, day out, doing our basic daily hygienic magical practices, which includes cleansing, banishing type things, as well as devotional practices or energy raising practices that enhance our ability to contain and healthfully channel this force, we grow stronger in our ability to utilize it. And for those magicians that choose to pair their magical work with explicit sexual work, it's a pretty phenomenal additional tool to have in the arsenal. And once you've done it and you realize the power of harnessing an already overwhelmingly intense force, the sexual experience and the ecstasy that comes from it, harnessing that to the magical practices you've been doing before, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer to keep using it once you've gotten to that place. Mm-hmm. The difference between having to sort of start from scratch and build up an ecstasy broadly defined of reaching a climax in a magical ritual that's not sexual versus doing that in a sexual magic approach where you've got so much ecstatic experience just waiting for you there already, that's a hugely important difference. So that's what I'd say about that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Point. Yeah.
I don't know that this is a good segue, but I see this as a very related topic because the sun and this energy that we're talking about, I feel, are analogous based on the Hermetic tradition or also other esoteric traditions.
Sure.
I want to ask you about Liber Resh Vel Helios. What is it? Why is it important? And just as a follow-up, if you could say anything about the symbolism versus the literal importance of the sun in our daily lives.
Well, let me start by working the segue aspect of this, because I think we should understand the sun as a symbol and the phallus as a symbol to be synonymous. Mm-hmm. or of one energy. My teacher, Phyllis Seckler, Sora Merrill, was always careful to talk about the phallus as something that both males and females have. That in her usage, the phallus was synonymous with Kundalini. It was a force resonant in both males and females and accessible via various means. Liber Resh Vel Helios is a ritual written by Aleister Crowley to be done four times a day at dawn, noon, dusk, and midnight. And one of the purposes is, to the extent that there may be physical benefits of attuning our consciousness to the station of the sun and seeking to be consciously united with it at those four points, then it enables us to do that. It also serves as a mindfulness practice throughout the day, so that four times a day we're reminded that we're on a spiritual path, that we are taking this seriously and pausing during our day to remember it and stay tuned into that aspiration. And it's also a chance to, if you approach it rightly, as I describe in my book, it's a chance to have a few moments of real energetic work, you know, to really power up right at those moments. For example, with some of the imagery that you can use in the Unity Uttermost Throat section, in the Unity section at the Adoration at the end, there are opportunities for multiple use of the sign of silence, which when rightly practiced and understood is a strengthening technique, a magical strengthening technique. So there are all kinds of benefits from regular use that conveniently line up with our daily lives and, you know, can be interwoven with our daily lives in a way that's meaningful. This is one of those places where Thelemic culture is growing too. I should relate a story. I posted about this on Facebook a few weeks ago, but as it happens, at the time, there was a Thelemite living in the house next door to us. And I was sitting at my laptop working on something, and I heard this sound, and I thought it was a non-human sound, and then I realized, but when the distractions of other noises calmed down, that this was a human chanting. And it turns out it was the Thelemite next door doing Liber Resh, and he was he had come to one of the places where you intone Aum, you know. And I thought, what a wonderful idea that we've come to the place where you can just be in a neighborhood, and the sound of the neighborhood is occasionally punctuated by people doing Liber Resh.
That's great.
And I realized I was sitting there thinking, what's that sound? Oh, this is the sound of my neighborhood. And it was just great. I hope that 20 years from now, that'll be a common experience for people. And here's hoping that that happens.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
And things like that. But that's all just to emphasize that Liber Resh is one of those aspects of culture that is shared and communal, can be shared and communal, and has that opportunity to weave together our lives communally as well as individually.
Do you also have any inkling about the import of Liber Resh? I mean, I know Crowley talks about it, like you can only do one or two things magically, like Liber Resh should be the number one thing. You know, this idea of the saluting the stations of the sun and,
right,
and connecting ourselves with the prime motivator and impetus in our little corner of the universe. It's almost I find like a deceptively simple practice, but yet over time the implications of what's actually going on can be quite profound.
Yeah, clearly Crowley put a lot of emphasis on it, and I think basically for many of the reasons I was listing, that it's you know, it's got all these levels of potential benefit for people. Of course, at the time that Crowley was writing and promulgating these pieces, he was very interested in promoting a Thelemic culture and the spread of Thelemic influence on culture. And so taking his cues from things like the Islamic prayers across the day and such, he was seeing the value of this as a community builder, potentially, and but undoubtedly the energetic benefits that we've been talking about, since they're so central to the system.
Now, in the book, you also write about the role of the ego in the great work, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I feel like a lot of times there are vastly differing opinions about the ego, its role, whether it should be somehow subjugated or not. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. Yeah, that's an incredibly important question, and I think one that bogs a lot of people down when they are wrestling with it. First of all, we know that what we can't do is actually destroy the ego, because the ego's role is as a mediator between inputs from the world around us and the inner life. It's a mediator between our individual consciousness and that of other people. It's a mediator between those glimmers of unconscious activity that we get through dreams or intuitions or other moments like that, other symbolic content, and our waking, you know, conscious awareness. So we need it. We simply wouldn't function as humans without it. So we know we're not going to have as a goal to actually stop the ego's functioning. What we need to do is create a state of transparency whereby the ego doesn't get in the way of our perception of truth. Most importantly, the truth in question is the truth of our own true will, which is inherently divine. And so anytime our ego is not liking the direction that our very soul wants us to go, it's in the way. And that dams up the flow of our own will. The other thing the ego does, of course, is it attempts to categorize everything and make life easier by having these boxes that things go in. Some of those boxes are labeled as good and evil. And when we realize that judging, that compartmentalizing of life done by the ego in order to feel better about going through our day is not always in our service. And when we back off from that and pause just for a second to go, okay, here's the reality in front of me. My ego doesn't like it. My ego thinks it's kind of repulsive, but let me stop and at least consider that here's where I am and here's what's happening to me before I judge it, push it away, and run away from it. If we can even just introduce that momentary pause, it's a foot in the door for the deeper self to assert itself, for the true will to have more of an influence on that moment than the ego does. And that's incredibly valuable. So a lot of the relationship to the ego has to do with treating it as a part of us instead of, as most of us have been taught to do, treat it as the center of who we are.
It's almost like a false center, if you will.
Yeah. It's a necessary, function of the psyche. Mm-hmm. But if we treat it more like a pet that we take care of and listen to and play with and feed, you know, occasionally, instead of, who are you, David? Oh, I'm my ego. So that, you know, when that's how we think of ourselves, and that's the limit of how we think of ourselves, we've cut ourselves off from most of who we are, and we've cut ourselves off from the most central and true aspects of who we are. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's my statement on ego.
I just want to finish up this section by talking a little bit about psychology and the view of psychology in relation to magic. I think there are probably a couple schools of thought on this. Obviously, one is psychology is a necessary boon and allows us to understand the mind and magic and metaphysical concepts in a way that maybe we hadn't before, and kind of advanced our understanding of the way these things function.
Right.
The other point of view is that psychology is reductionist and materialist and tries to explain away great powers or non-human intelligences in a very scientific sort of manner.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, obviously, I think I know where your opinion falls in that spectrum, but I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the idea of the application of psychology to magical thought.
Well, I think one of the first things that's important to point out is that psychology is not monolithic, and there are approaches in psychology that where their explicit mission is to recognize the transpersonal nature of human life. There are other approaches where the mission is to define everything in terms of behaviors, rather than, you know, psychological contents in of a more subtle sort, and everything in between. So, I think we have to be careful when we talk about what psychology is a quote unquote attempting to do in terms of its explanations, because that's going to depend hugely on which camp you're talking to. So that said, I think what serves any individual magician is to know themselves as well as possible. And 100+ years of psychology, modern psychology, has given us a great set of tools to do that. Not the only set, not always the best set, but a great set and a well-researched set. So I don't think there's any excuse for not using the tools that we know of in the interest of self-knowledge and self-exploration. As a preliminary to and an adjunct to the magical path all along the way. And you only have to look as far as people like Israel Regardi and Phyllis Seckler and certainly myself in terms of people who have recommended this strongly. Mm-hmm. Now, the other issue aside from the self-knowledge aspect is that debate about are we using psychology in such a way that it is trying to explain everything that happens in magic as if it is purely and only a mental phenomenon, nothing metaphysical, nothing that fits some definition of spiritual. And I think there are people that think of it that way and that work with it that way, and that's fine. I also think that on the other end of this other end of the spectrum, there are people who want to approach magic as a purely devotional or spiritual practice and purposely avoid casting it in psychological terms. And then there's everything in between. Mm-hmm. The good news is that Crowley left for us a structure of a system of training, and without fail, anytime I've seen someone follow the system, I'm speaking primarily of AA here, whenever I've seen someone follow the system, it doesn't matter how they've been defining what God is or isn't, or what magic is or isn't, because if they follow the steps, they get to a place where they get all the answers they need about that. Mm-hmm. Their experience teaches them what they need to know. And definitions fall away in the face of the intensity of that experience. So one thing people should not worry about is that the way they think about magic as they're beginning the path is going to potentially throw them way off, you know.
Yeah, right.
If they just stay, and the key is staying open to experience and staying open to configuring your interpretations. Just don't close yourself off by deciding it's all mental or it's all metaphysical or whatever. And you'll be fine.
So just to wrap up this section, I want to again say thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this evening, Dr. David Shoemaker. The book is Living Thelema, A Practical Guide to Attainment in Aleister Crowley's System of Magic, published by Anima Solis, available on Amazon. You can find links in the show notes as well. And I'm just wondering if you could remind people listening where they can find you and your work online.
Sure. The main hub to find out about all my work is livingthelema.com. And on that site, you'll find a bio about me and all the groups I work with and represent. So you can easily click your way through to anything you're interested in finding out about, such as International College of Thelema, Temple of the Silver Star, AA, and Ordo Templi Orientis. And also on that site, there's resources that are keyed to the different podcast episodes and reading lists and things like that expand on them, demonstration videos. So I think people can find out what they need to know all through that site.
Excellent. So thank you again, Dr. David Shoemaker. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope people enjoyed this and will check out your work further.
All right. Thanks very much for having me.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Dr. David Shoemaker, author of Living Thelema, discusses the AA, the initiatory order organized by Aleister Crowley in 1907. He also talks about his teacher and mentor, Phyllis Seckler. Finally, Dr. Shoemaker provides some words of advice and inspiration for students on the path with regard to the importance of not giving up and dealing with a partner who's on a different spiritual path than you. Join us for that important conversation. Just browse to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. Not only will you get access to this great additional interview with David Shoemaker, but more than 100 others, all while supporting the podcast. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.